Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Hello, everyone. We're so excited to have you join us once again for another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. We have another special guest with us, Julia O'Brien, who retired in 2023 as the FEMA region second geospatial coordinator. And of course, we're going to go into specifics of what that means. In that role, she worked toward building connections in the geospatial community with FEMA and within the region two emergency management communities of New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Julia also worked to improve GIS or geospatial information systems capabilities in FEMA region two and is responsible for improving project management process within the region. Julia was involved in remote sensing and GIS for over 30 years and as a project manager for over 25 years. Before FEMA, she was a senior project manager working on the Emergency Communications Transformation Program, or ESTP for short, for New York City, responsible for management of $15 million multi-year budget project to create a complete and accurate GIS data set of all the streets and addresses in New York City, ultimately called CSCL. Julia has managed projects involving environmental remediation, environmental impact statements, and environmental assessments, particularly where the use of GIS was required. In the 1980s, she worked at the USGS Data Center, initially doing research and applications of remotely sensed data and earth resources data sets being developed by the USGS. Julia also has been an adjunct professor both at Seton Hall University and Touro College, where she taught introductory courses in GIS. And of course, most importantly, Julia is a mother of one son and a grandmother to twin eight-year-olds. So let's give another hearty Bioethics in the Margins welcome to Julia. We're so happy to have you with us.
Yeah, I echo that. You're very welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. And it's great to have someone here to talk a little bit about FEMA and what's happening with FEMA right now. But before we dive into that, maybe you can tell us a bit more about geospatial information systems. I'm hearing a lot now of like friends, children studying this, and it seems to be a very popular area now. So can you give us an idea of what it is and like why it's important in your line of work?
Absolutely. I used to like to tell people I was the grandmother of GIS because when I went through grad school, it didn't exist yet. But what it is basically is a combination of computer systems, data sets, software, and a knowledgeable analyst that can do geospatial analysis. So what do I mean by that? I mean where things are and how their spatial location affects things. So, you know, one of the uses, for instance, is if you have a good data set, like we created CSCL in the city of New York, which was citywide street center lines. On every line, they had information about what the address ranges were. We had information about the direction of traffic. We had information about where stop signs and stoplights and all that stuff were. So if you took that data set and you put it in GIS, you could analyze it to determine, for instance, the best way to do your delivery routes if you were a company. You know, so that's one pretty simple use of that kind of software and data. But for agencies like FEMA and environmental, you're generally looking for what gets impacted by something. So, for instance, if a hurricane is coming in, the National Hurricane Center will put out depth grid for where they expect flooding to happen coastally. And they put that out every 6 hours. And so you would take that data and on the fly, you start analyzing it for what critical infrastructure is likely to be impacted, what hospitals are likely to be impacted, what prisons are likely to be impacted because those people can't get out, right? What police stations, what fire stations. And you try to make sure that you know what's lying in the past so you can be prepared for it. You also look at how many people are in those areas and usually the evacuations have taken place before all of that, so you don't usually have to worry about that so much. But you want to be sure that you're looking at the whether the areas that were evacuated are sufficient or not. So that's the kind of analysis you do with GIS. And as time has gone by over the years, more and more data has been available, a lot of which has been developed by the federal government. And that is one area of concern when you start cutting a lot of these agencies. NOAA is responsible for a lot of really good data. The USGS is responsible for a lot of really good data. FEMA itself is responsible for a lot of really good data. So it's important not to lose those.
So you mentioned about something like flooding, how you would use GIS to try and understand who needs to be evacuated, what areas are going to be impacted. What other, I mean, many listeners will probably know this already, but FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. What other types of disasters does FEMA respond to? I think wildfires is one right now that's applicable.
FEMA responds to any kind of natural or man-made disaster. So FEMA currently resides under the Department of Homeland Security, and most of the agencies in Homeland Security are responsible for enforcement and protection, right? But FEMA is responsible for consequence management. So any kind of natural disaster, any kind of man-made disaster, you know, for instance, if you have a release of some chemical, then FEMA is responsible for responding to that. But let me backtrack for just half a second on that, because when I say any kind of disaster, that's true. But disaster response starts locally. So, you know, you start to have a flood, the town is going to be taking care of, you know, the immediate needs around that flood. And they call in the county when they can't handle what they're doing. And the county calls in the state when their resources are exceeded. And the state calls in FEMA. FEMA can't just go into a state and start responding, right? So the idea that the current administration is saying, well, we're only going to meet the needs over what the state can do, that's the law. It's the law always. In fact, in order to get a disaster declared, the governor of the state has to write a letter requesting it. They submit it to their local region, and there are 10 regions of FEMA in the country. They review it for rational sense. And if they deem that it seems like something could be declared, they give it to the president. And the president is responsible for declaring a national disaster. So that's how it's always worked, right? FEMA doesn't respond to my local, you know, forest fire. We had fires in South Jersey earlier this year, wildfires. FEMA never got involved with those because the state was handling them. But, you know, when you talk about wildfires like we had in Los Angeles last fall, yes, you have thousands of, you know, homes impacted. It exceeds the ability of the state to manage that. So that's when FEMA gets involved.
So apart from sort of predicting, you know, impending disasters, reviewing states' requests for help, you know, can you give us other ideas of what FEMA does, what it provides, what support it gives, how it responds on the ground to these emergencies?
Well, it does more than just respond on the ground. So there are various parts of FEMA, right? One of the divisions of FEMA is preparedness. So, you know, we do things to help communities prepare themselves for natural disasters. One of the organizations is the CERT program that you may have heard of, which is Community Emergency Response Trainees, maybe. and they're local people who are trained to help during a disaster. Because as they say, all disasters begin locally. If, you know, under Obama, we had a administrator whose name was Craig Fugate. And Fugate used to say, the first 48 are on you, meaning it's going to take us that long to respond on a national level. And it frequently takes less time than that because we are allowed to pre-stage since Katrina. But in reality, when the disaster first starts happening, it's the local police and fire and emergency management groups that deal with it. So they need help preparing. Sometimes they need funding. FEMA actually prepares, has a grants division in it, and it buys fire trucks for fire companies. So we're involved in the kind of aspects of preparing for things. We also require counties to have hurricane management plans, and we work with them to develop those plans so that they're not unprepared when something happens. They know who has to do what. They know how many people, they know the timeline for when they need to do evacuations. You know, all of that stuff has to be planned in advance. And there are a lot of aspects to planning in advance. You have to look at not only what you think, but you have to look at the communities that you're serving. And there's a difference depending on your point of view of who you are in life. You're going to have a different response to what happens to you in a disaster. So, for instance, if you are someone who is dependent on oxygen and the electricity goes out, there has to be a plan in place to make sure that you don't die. And that is, you know, a huge part of the planning process. If you are someone who has developmental disabilities, then you may need special care when you're being evacuated. They have to plan for helping you evacuate. And as we learned in Katrina, we have to help people plan for evacuating their pets because people won't leave if they have to leave their pets behind. There's a lot of aspects that it's helpful to have a diverse input in that planning so that they look at the various communities and see how they best respond and make plans that work for them. So we do that. There's also a mitigation division. And mitigation is the group, you know, you've all seen the floodplain maps, right? And your home insurance is based on whether you're in the floodplain or outside of the 100-year floodplain. Mitigation is the group responsible for creating those. And in the United States, flood insurance is all managed by FEMA. No one insurance company could handle the extent of flood insurance, so the federal government does it. And it's not a be-all and end-all kind of insurance. I always warn people, you can only get $250,000 worth of insurance for flood insurance, and very few homes in New Jersey are covered by that. But, you know, it's the first way of protecting the ability to recover, right? So mitigation does that. And mitigation also will look at areas that, for instance, have frequent floods and work with communities to help them find ways to mitigate those floods. Sometimes they create a green acre zone where they don't allow development because that area floods. Sometimes they help build dikes. Sometimes they do other, you know, mitigation procedures. So there's that. And then, you know, In the actual disaster part of it, FEMA does both recovery and response. Response comes first, right? That's making sure that we get you the bulldozers you need, making sure that, you know, the compact with other states is in place. The state does that, but we support that. It's called EMAC, and it's Emergency Management Assistance Compact, and states have agreements that they will help each other when this happens. And then, you know, so some of the aid comes from other states sometimes, and sometimes the federal government steps in and starts coordinating things. When a natural disaster is declared, there are two people put in charge. There's a federal coordinating officer and a state coordinating officer, and they are co-equal partners in leading the response effort. And then as the days go by, we morph into recovery. So this is how, you know, people start to get back from the impacts. So in recovery, there are two basic programs. There's individual assistance, which is what helps households. So people, if you know, if your house has been damaged, if your roof is gone, whatever, you can register with FEMA. And while FEMA has a limit on how much money they pay individuals in cash, and it's pretty low, they can help you get lined up with other resources. They make small business loans available to individual people at a very low rate of interest so that people have a chance to recover and get back, you know, where they were. And then there's public assistance, where the federal government helps local entities do things like in Hurricane Sandy in New York, you know, a lot of the boardwalks in New Jersey were wiped out. So a lot of those boardwalks were replaced by FEMA funds. The dunes were built up as a better barrier, and that helped, you know, recovery did some of that, but mitigation was involved in that, right? So there are a lot of ways that FEMA helps people and the governments around those people to recover. In wildfires, we don't do the fighting of the wildfires, but we do the funding for the fighting of the wildfires. And we, in fact, do then start paying out for people who've been burned out, and we give them assistance. And there are other agencies, there are volunteer agencies that help with that as well. We work very closely with the Red Cross, for instance. And but it's all coordinated through with something called a joint field office, which is run by the federal coordinating officer and the state coordinating officer.
Absolutely fascinating. When we actually look at bioethics, Julia, we never ever think about organizations like FEMA. And of course, FEMA is definitely connected to making sure everyone is healthy, safe. It is something that really isn't talked about and is really overlooked within bioethics. So just hearing about not just the complexities of FEMA, but the importance of the overall health and well-being of individuals, even traditionally thought as you said, outside of emergencies, FEMA does so much more. This has been really insightful. So my question is, and of course, this is the big elephant in the room, and it's no surprise that FEMA, along with other organizations, have dramatic cuts. And from the sound of it, obviously, there are going to be really terrible consequences. And I'm just curious on your thoughts, and feel free if you want to stand on your soapbox, that's completely fine. What are the consequences of cutting FEMA's? Obviously, you mentioned all of the work that FEMA does, but what really would be the implications of cutting FEMA in the way that we see on the news that is going to be cut?
It kind of depends on where the cuts happen. Now, the other thing is, be aware there are two sources of funding for FEMA. So there's the congressional allocation, and that pays for all of the full-time employees, right? But FEMA has relatively few full-time employees. Like I read in, I'm trying to think, you know, they keep saying USAID was only 1% of the budget, right? And they have about, at any given time, between 5 and 10,000 employees for USAID. FEMA, when I joined FEMA, had 5,000 permanent full-time employees. That's pretty small when you consider we're covering 50 states and seven territories, right? Six territories, sorry. But the bottom line is, those people are paid by the congressional allocation. So the FEMA administrator, the guy who runs everything, you know, he's paid for that. But all of the people in permanent jobs who are there learning to do the planning, and that can be there year after year after year, building up expertise, those people are going to start to be cut. And then you're going to lose institutional knowledge, and you're going to lose the ability to put into place some programs like the mitigation programs that are helpful to communities going forward. But the other part of FEMA's budget is the Disaster Relief Fund. And that gets funded by Congress as needed. And it's very political. So after Hurricane Sandy, you might remember that the senator from South Carolina wanted to know why we were increasing the disaster recovery fund for a state as rich as New York, right? But the very next year, South Carolina had massive amounts of flooding, and he was the first one in line with his hand out looking for disaster recovery funds for South Carolina. And the truth is that there is a threshold that each state has to pass before they're eligible for FEMA funds. And those thresholds are based on the capabilities of the state itself. So the threshold for New York and New Jersey is much higher than the threshold for Mississippi or South Carolina, right? Because those states have less resources to be able to respond. So people might not see the day-to-day cuts in a disaster, because there are a lot of employees that are paid by the disaster relief fund. There are various levels of employees. We always used to joke at FEMA, we had a caste system. So, you know, you had the senior executive people, and then you had the permanent full-time employees. And then you had the core employees, which were cadre on response emergencies or something. And that was technically a temporary job. You got a 2 to 4 year contract. And if they didn't need you anymore, they cut the job and you were gone, right? And then we have reservists who come in specifically during disasters and work in the JFOs. And when I first started FEMA, a lot of those people were retired. So you go to the JFOs and you never saw so much gray hair in your life. But they were people with life experience who were prepared to help. And then they were supplemented by many times by people who just gotten out of college. So it was quite very young, very old. Now they've nationalized the reservist corps. And so people come in that way and sometimes work their way up. And then finally, we have local hire people that we hire on the spot to do specific jobs. And they don't get any benefits. But they are also paid by disaster recovery funds. So the vast majority of the people in FEMA are paid by disaster recovery funds, so that they can ramp up or ramp down as they need to. So that will help to some extent mitigate the cuts, because even the most conservative Republican senator wants disaster recovery funds when his state gets hit. And the reality is that many of the states that get hit over and over and over again are red states. It just happens to be there in the area where there are a lot of hurricanes or a lot of tornadoes. So they're the ones who need a lot of the funding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing. So how much actually does it cost to run the agency? Or I know that depends on, as you mentioned before, in Congress and how much money is allocated. I mean, other factors that you mentioned, but do you have a actual estimate or average of how much it costs? And also, how many people does FEMA help annually? I know that is also fluctuates based off of national emergencies and all of that.
It fluctuates wildly. It fluctuates wildly. And it's more every year. And the answer, I don't have a specific amount of money, but I will tell you that it's more expensive every year. And that's largely because, as a result of the climate change that nobody's supposed to talk about in the federal government again, our disasters are worse than they ever were. So, you know, when I joined FEMA, most people had never seen a Cat 5 hurricane. But by, you know, 5 years ago, we were getting 2 or 3 a year. And those are really bad hurricanes. I mean, they do a lot of damage when they hit land. You might recall that Hurricane Dorian sat on top of the Bahamas for 5 days, and there were 2,000 bodies they never found because they were washed out to sea. And they were, in fact, they were not sure of the entire count because not all of them were legal residents of the Bahamas. So, you know, obviously the poorer and most marginal groups are the people who live in the most dangerous areas, and they are disproportionately impacted by every disaster. The most expensive disaster in 2012 that had ever been was Hurricane Sandy. And every year since then, there has been a hurricane that has, or not every year, but every few years since then, there's been a disaster that tops it. So when Hurricane Maria happened in Puerto Rico, and there was no power in Puerto Rico for 6 months, and there were 70,000 landslides in the island, taking out roads and water systems and you name it, that became the most expensive disaster in the history. So, and now there's been something since then that's more expensive than that, right? So because these disasters are more severe, they tend to increase. How many people does FEMA help in any given year? In the hundreds of thousands. Some people a little bit, some people a lot, right? And they, you know, and then, you know, and that's not just individual assistance, but those are people that are helped by the public assistance projects that take place, right? So you have to look at that and say how many people are impacted by the fact that this road was wiped out and FEMA funds helped repair that road so that people could travel. So it's disasters are getting worse. Forest fires are getting worse. Hurricanes are getting worse. Flooding is getting worse. All of it needs more and more money all the time. And you can't ignore that. And in fact, even during the first Trump administration, when they were telling us we couldn't talk about global warming or we couldn't talk about climate change, we had to make our plans based on those changes, even if you called it something else, because you have to plan for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And before we shift and talk a little bit about USAID, and of course, Amelia has a few questions about that. I'm sure you heard, to your disdain, I'm sure, about, you know, the term DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how that has unfortunately been used to weaponize the diversity, not just of what people look like, but also their experiences, their different lived experiences, their cultures, all of that within different echelons in the federal government. To you, how important is diversity in FEMA, particularly so?
I cannot stress enough how important diversity is in FEMA. When you are planning for disasters. Let me backtrack for just a second. I think it's important for any kind of decision making because you are stronger when you have more than one idea in the room, right? So, and those ideas can be different from different people's lived experiences. If you have a group of people who all have the same experiences, they're going to come up with a pretty good plan that will take care of people like them, but they may not be aware of the needs of other groups, or they may not be aware of other perspectives. And so for a long time, FEMA has been very diverse, and we need to be very diverse because the population we serve is everybody. It isn't like hurricanes only hit middle-class white guys' houses, right? It hits communities of color. It hits people with disabilities. It hits, people with cultural understandings that are different from our own, right? And by our own, I mean I'm a middle-class white woman, right? So having those people in the room when you're writing your plans, having those people in the room when you're working on your response is all important. Now, my region was Region 2, and Region 2 is New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. New York and New Jersey are very different from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And, you know, Puerto Rico, most people speak Spanish, you know. So you have to be able to communicate with those people. You also have to be able to take into account their perspectives so that they will do things that you need them to do, and so that they're not traumatized in ways they don't need to be traumatized. One of the largest disasters, actually the most expensive disaster as far as I'm aware at the time, was COVID. COVID was a declared disaster in all 50 states and all 6 territories. And in the Virgin Islands, we have two populations that are somewhat marginalized, and that is the Dominican population and the Haitian population. And so they were having a very hard time getting those two populations to consider being vaccinated. And it isn't because they don't care about medicine. It was because they weren't really sure that medicine that would work on white Americans was going to work on them. It's a cultural skepticism about what gets brought to them from other cultures. And it's not an invalid skepticism. So one of my colleagues went to the head of the response division and said, "You just sent two of the whitest people I know down to the US Virgin Islands to try to get people to get vaccinated. Can I suggest you start sending down a few people of color?" And she gave a list because, hey, we have Haitian people. We have, she was from St. Lucia. We had a number of people from the Caribbean who could go down, who would be much better at selling the idea of getting vaccines to other Caribbean people. And I don't know whether that ever actually happened or not, but I know that that was a valuable input into getting understanding that there's a reason there's hesitancy sometimes that you don't understand. And that's all important when you're doing disaster response. All important. And so when you say, "Oh, we don't need those people," it's ignorant. You need everybody so that you can serve the people that you are hoping to serve and understand their perspectives well enough to make sure that you actually provide them the help they need. Thank you for letting me do my little soapbox.
No, thank you. That was really, really great points, and we agree with you completely. And thank you also for drawing attention to climate change, because it seems to me like FEMA's needed more and more because, partially climate change, disasters are worse and they're more frequent. So we need FEMA more than ever now. There's been quite a lot in the news about USAID and how that's been dismantled. How does that connect to threats to FEMA as an agency?
Well, I think it's based on the same kind of one, ignorance of what they do, and ignorance of what the impact of what they do is. So, USAID, like FEMA, is another small agency. They have between 5 and 10,000 people working for them at any given time. They have contractors who work for them that expands, and again, they're scalable the way FEMA is. They have a lot of responsibilities that are beyond FEMA's responsibilities. For instance, they're involved in things for economic development that FEMA is not involved in, or they're in, and they're, of course, they're all for other countries. They're USAID, I think, is in 60 countries. And but they do have an area of helping to respond to natural disasters. So drought is a big one that happens in Africa that they have often helped with. They also have, of course, medical projects that they do. They've been very involved in fighting AIDS in Africa, and AIDS in Africa has been a lot worse than it was in the United States. As devastating as it was here, it was much more devastating in Africa for a lot longer time. And when you assume that it's no longer your responsibility to help other people, whether they're your citizens or the citizens of the world, it's a very short-sighted view. Both USAID and FEMA sort of operate on the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? So if you help countries in Asia or Africa or, wherever USAID works achieve their economic goals, then you make the world a safer and better place for everybody, right? And, the US didn't go into this out of completely beneficial goals. They were very clear on, we're using this to build our influence in the world and make sure that it's safer for us, and that we have the influence we need to get things done that we think need to be done. If USAID goes away, all of those programs will go away for a while, but other countries will step into the gap. And one of the countries that apparently the White House is very concerned about, but doesn't seem to be concerned enough about, is China. China has done a lot of work building roads, building infrastructure for developing countries in South America and in Africa, and probably in Asia. And if we aren't giving them what they need, China will. And China is perfectly capable of doing the medical stuff as well. And so that will erode U.S. influence in the world while making, at least temporarily, life much worse for people who have been relying on that aid. Medications in Africa that people suddenly don't get, people are going to die. That's not a joke. That's not a good policy decision if for any government. You need to, if you're going to put those programs in place, you need to support those programs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's our last question, because I know that FEMA is your primary particular agency, because, of course, you worked there for so long. So thank you for just sharing a little bit about USAID and, of course, the different correlations between FEMA and USAID. From a, we like to say, a bioethical perspective or a moral perspective, what message do you have for those who made these particular decisions, those individuals that are politicizing, literally, as you alluded to earlier, people's lives when their backs against the wall, whether it's a natural disaster or if they just need help because something unexpectedly has happened to them that they never believed that they will actually endure. Yeah, what is your message? What are your thoughts on that? And how do you think the medical community and just communities connected to health overall, what can we do to be more advocates to try to make some change that already, you know, has been done for the worst, unfortunately?
Well, I guess it's a bit of a two-part answer for me. What would I say to the people who think that cutting funding for government programs that help the residents of our country or other countries? And that is, why do you think that's good policy? The government will not stand if the population does not support it. And it isn't a moral judgment on someone if they need help at some given point in their lives. People are not poor because they are not hardworking. People are not in a natural disaster because they were careless. They need help when they need help, and it's government's responsibility to provide the needed help. And so, you know, when you start talking about cost cutting, yes, of course, in every natural disaster, there's a certain amount of waste because you're looking at the need to respond rapidly and get help to people fast, balanced against the need to be accountable for the funds you spend. FEMA is audited more than any agency I can imagine, except USAID. Heavily audited. You have to pass audits. They audit the regions. They audit the programs. They audit the disasters, right? Because they are aware that it is a ripe area for waste. But I would argue the waste is much smaller than other areas of the government, and the need is much greater. And if government doesn't serve the people, then it's not necessary. What can the medical community do? I hope that the medical community will make sure that every time someone dies from a disease that should have been treatable, but research was taken away, that they personalize it and they make sure that everybody knows. Because honestly, there are so many research projects being cut, so many, and they're not all affected, because honestly, the drug companies are funding research, many other groups fund research, but the government is an important source of research, and research is necessary for moving medicine along. And so if you don't allow that research to happen, you're going to be a generation behind. And again, people will die unnecessarily. And I can't see how that's good government policy. It's just not.
Yeah, so we really do need to highlight like the role of government, federal government, state government in these times, because I do think a lot of people don't understand how much they can potentially help and how we may all need their help at some stage or another. Well, thank you so much for being here. This has been a really, really good discussion. And yeah, we really appreciate you coming on and helping us understand more about FEMA and your role in GIS and up and coming trendy specialty for people, which is obviously really essential to do the work that FEMA and other agencies do.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on bioethics in the margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.